First case for argument today is number 10-2960, Cleary and others against Philip Morris and others. Arguing for the appellants, Mr. Joyce.
Good morning, Your Honor. The plaintiffs have asserted an independent unjust enrichment claim against these defendants since 1998. Along the way, they also attempted to assert claims under the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act and for public nuisance. But each of those claims were mooted by decisions of the Illinois Supreme Court, so that there no longer is any possibility to pursue those claims. Plaintiffs' only claims now are for unjust enrichment. Plaintiffs believe they cannot assert a common law fraud claim or a statutory claim based under Illinois law because the measure of damages, as spelled out recently by Justice Carmeier in the Price appeal, is a benefit of the bargain. And the court went on at some length to demonstrate how you could never allege and prove a benefit of the bargain damage claim in a tobacco case. Plaintiffs know of no fraud or statutory-based claim they can pursue against these defendants, and significantly, defendants have suggested none. Although plaintiffs do not concede that Illinois law only permits a party to pursue an independent claim for unjust enrichment when they have no other claim, in this case, plaintiffs have no other claim. And importantly, the defendants have conceded in their responsive brief at pages 35 and 37 that where unjust enrichment is invoked because plaintiffs have no tort, contract, or statutory claim, and unjust enrichment is the only vehicle that can be used to seek restitution of the monies in question, it is that type of situation where an unjust enrichment claim is of necessity an independent claim. We think that's a significant concession by the defendants.
Well, our precedent is directly against that.
Your Honor, admittedly, there is significant precedent in the Illinois Appellate Court that goes
I don't care about the Illinois Appellate Court. I'm saying this court has ruled contrary to your position.
This court has two divergent opinions. I believe in Siegel versus Shell Oil, they have disagreed with our decision, but they also were interpreting Illinois law. In one of the other cases,
it's still a decision.
Your Honor, there's no question about it. No question about it. And later in my argument, I'm going to talk to you about what I think should be done about the fact that there seems to be a conflict at the Illinois appellate court level and a divergence of opinion at this court on a significant issue of Illinois law.
You said we have divergent opinions?
I believe so.
And obviously Siegel says what it says. It may or may not be dicta. But what else are you relying on there?
At Ocala, I might be mispronouncing it, but and that was a situation where the appeal came from a denial of a motion for class certification, and the court said, I think probably in dicta, the same thing that HPI says, that you can have an independent cause of action for unjust enrichment. The problem with many of the appellate court decisions are they're dicta. In fact, there's one I just read last night where the court said the plaintiffs failed to preserve the appeal on unjust enrichment, so we can't deal with it. And that went on for three pages talking about it.
Mr. Joyce, I know you want to talk about unjust enrichment, but you lead off your briefs with a jurisdictional argument, which is it's hard to ignore, but I didn't see any authority cited. I didn't see even a standard of review suggested.
We're satisfied that the district court had jurisdiction.
And that you're withdrawing your argument about whether it should have remanded?
The only argument we made there is he had the discretion to remand. He exercised discretion and didn't do it. So we're abandoning that point on appeal.
Okay, that simplifies things.
Now, notwithstanding the fact that the defendants concede there are certain situations where you can allege an appropriate unjust enrichment claim, they continue to argue here that we are required to try and come up with the traditional tort or statutory claim of breach of contract and that we abandon all those claims in order to set up an unjust enrichment claim. They've never yet pointed to any cause of action we could have alleged. Any cause of action we ever did allege, they pointed out to courts in their briefs that we couldn't state that cause of action. So to me, it's a circular argument. Now, the district court, we think, incorrectly concluded that unjust enrichment cannot be an independent cause of action, that it instead has to be tethered to some other traditional claim like a tort, a breach of contract, or a statutory violation. Again, the district court has just adopted the decision of two Illinois appellate courts, which are directly contrary to HPI Services, the only Illinois decision that clearly spelled out the elements of the cause of action for unjust enrichment. Now, admittedly, the Illinois appellate court has not been called to discuss whether or not to state that unjust enrichment claim. You also have to establish you have no other claims. That was never something they said in HPI. They never asked to address that issue. That's an issue we believe that you should send back to the Illinois Supreme Court to address. Okay. Now,
Joyce, let me ask you. Let's assume we agree with you that an unjust enrichment can be a standalone claim, whether you've got anything else or not.
Right.
What's your best case from Illinois to show that the kind of detriment you're alleging here, namely that the plaintiffs bought these cigarettes without knowing the full dangers, but without arguing that they relied upon that lack of information in making the decisions. What's your best case for saying that Illinois would recognize that as a detriment calling for an unjust enrichment remedy?
There's no really good case on detriment in Illinois that goes any which way. Raintree Homes, an Illinois Supreme Court decision, made it very clear that detriment does not require actual loss. So we read that to mean it doesn't require you to actually have suffered from a recognized tort or statutory violation.
You get that out of Raintree. That was the impact fee rescission effort, right?
It was, right. It's admittedly dicta, but it's in Raintree. We cited the page and line in our briefs. The problem with a lot of the authority on unjust enrichment in detriment is that it is dicta, and that it comes from learned treatises, and it comes from decisions where that issue was not squarely elaborated on. No one's ever asked the Illinois Supreme Court to confront these issues and give any guidance.
Well, let me ask you a more fundamental question about your theory. I want to take this in two steps. First of all, if I understand your position, your theory is that your clients and your proposed class is entitled to the gross receipts of all sales of the product. Is that right?
Well, we've asked for a disgorgement of revenue or profits.
And if you're asking for all revenues.
Well, at some points in the pleadings, you see all revenues. Other points, you see revenues and profits. I don't think at this stage.
What do you think the theory is?
I believe that ultimately a court would look at profits.
Okay. I suspect that you're right. Now, let's assume we're talking about profits. And let's assume we could be talking about cigarettes. We could be talking about the old Dalkon Shield IUDs. We could be talking about asbestos. Let's suppose you've got defendants who've been selling a deadly and dangerous product,
right,
while concealing its dangers. Assume that. Under your theory, if I understand it correctly, all of the profits, all money available to pay any damages to injured consumers, would be spread out based upon the purchase, leaving nothing for those who were actually injured or killed. Is that right?
I wouldn't phrase it that way.
I know you wouldn't, but why not?
We're focusing on the benefit derived by the defendant.
But you're saying that all of the benefit, that you would empty that deep pocket completely and spread it evenly among all purchasers rather than holding anything back for those who are actually injured or killed. Is that right?
We've never gotten to that issue, Judge.
I'm asking you that issue. That's the logic of your position.
I think it's certainly a place you could go, but if...
Why on earth would a court system do that instead of providing damages for and adopt a theory that would empty the deep pocket for people who don't even claim to have been hurt and leave nothing for those who were injured or killed.
Because restitution focuses essentially on the benefit derived by the defendant as opposed to the damage of the plaintiff.
So we ought to ignore?
No, Your Honor. A court of equity could easily and should deal with that issue. It would be very appropriate for a court of equity to hold back sufficient funds to take care of people with personal injury claims.
You're talking hundreds of billions of dollars.
And I know I'm talking billions. I don't know whether it's hundreds.
Well, if you're talking about all these cigarettes and all this period of time,
A 10-year period of time in Illinois for Class A and probably a 10-year period of time for Class B. It's a great deal of money. Great deal of money. But the money that this defendant derived was only through what courts have concluded was the most outrageous conduct possible. I mean, they lied to Congress, they lied to the courts, they lied to the public, and they did so in order to keep selling an inherently dangerous product that has caused untold damage to people in Illinois and elsewhere. It's caused untold damage to the health care system, to the public health system.
It's still legal, isn't it?
It is still legal.
Yeah. But why not make money available to pay the damages to those who are injured? Under your theory, lots of this money would go to folks who are perfectly happy to keep buying and smoking light cigarettes even after they know the truth, right?
I would take exception to that. They're not perfectly happy to, but they certainly are. I have statistics in my argument that I could point out that 87% of people who start to smoke can't quit, and 70% of those try to. So they're not happy, but they can't quit.
Mm-hmm.
And the name of the game here from the tobacco company is to get them smoking early. Give it to them if necessary, and they will continue to smoke. Why? The older smokers are dying. This is the most callous approach I've ever seen in my life to a product. They've known since the 50s how dangerous this product was. They did everything possible to create confusion and doubt so that people would start smoking and keep smoking so they could replace people who were dying from smoking-related injuries like heart and lung. So, yeah, we're looking for disgorgement of their ill-gotten gain. Assaulting will try and find a reasonable way to allocate it among the people who purchased and consumed cigarettes. And without a doubt, we would never resist keeping back a sufficient fund to take care of people with personal injury claims.
How would the court do that? And can you direct me to any precedents when you're talking about an extraordinary equitable effort, aren't you?
A court of chancery is limited only by its imagination. I'm assuming that a court of chancery would have the benefit of the best expert testimony available as to what would be an appropriate holdback and what would be an appropriate disgorgement. But remember, these defendants, again in a callous fashion, started to disclose what was going on here in 2005. Why? They did that so they could start the statute of limitations running on personal injury claims. So there's no claim against them for a failure to disclose after 2005. And they've made a lot of money since then. There'll be no tag days for these defendants, I don't think.
You had taken the position that you don't have to show causation or...
Absolutely.
Is that right?
Absolutely, because we're looking here for restitution. That focuses only on the defendant, not on the plaintiff. The plaintiff doesn't have to show causation, damage, reliance.
You don't have to show who got hurt or why they got
Correct.
Hurt.
Correct. In fact, we're never alleging our class got hurt.
Hmm?
We're never alleging our class got hurt. Anybody who got hurt has a personal injury claim, which they can pursue themselves. We're talking about people who smoked and are still smoking. The detriment they suffered is they either started to smoke or kept smoking because of the failure to disclose.
The bottom line is that they were injured in some way by false, deceptive advertising.
That is correct.
I think.
That is correct. I agree with
that.
Right? I agree with that.
And once addicted, they can't quit.
I'm sorry.
I just said once addicted, they can't quit. You seem to think that.
The statistics I could cite to you from our brief say 87% of the folks who try to quit can't. They're back smoking in a year. We have statistics that show that if you've gone through surgery for lung cancer, you're sitting in your room smoking out of the operating room.
But you're not alleging that reliance, are you?
Not at all.
Okay.
I don't have to allege it. I mean, I don't...
You understand that's your position that
I'm
you
sorry,
don't
you're
have
right.
to.
Right.
And you aren't even arguing that your clients purchased because of the false information.
No.
Okay.
No. They were subjected to false advertising in the sense that there was not a clear-cut statement they were required to give, and in the sense they made half statements which were false.
As I was reading your briefs, frankly, I was thinking about, for example, securities claims, securities fraud claims, where the theory in essence is there's false information out in the market, but the only people who can make claims are those who say, I made a purchase and then made a sale in reliance upon the market price. And you're not even making those allegations.
Not at all. But in the securities context, that is exactly the nature of the cause of action as defined by the district court, by the federal court system. Mm-hmm. And we also have to show damage. Your Honor, my time is up, and I'm happy to answer any more questions.
That's your rebuttal time that you're saving, right?
If you would like me to answer questions, I will.
Check and see. Let me ask you, Mr. Joyce, before the defense gets up, the defense has said, in essence, look, you're proposing an extraordinary new standard of liability here that would say that a manufacturer can be forced to forfeit, if I may quote their briefs, I'll switch from revenues to profits, but forced to forfeit all the profits that a product has generated simply because a court later concludes that potential dangers were not fully disclosed. You said in your reply you're not reaching that broadly, but I don't see how you limit the principles you're arguing for here.
It assaulted that mind to the point where widows and orphans would be crying for them. I mean, the cause of action started in the 1500s in England. It is not a new cause of action. The fact that these people would be asked to disgorge profits that they unjustly get to make, they knew before they started to lie and before they started to not make full disclosures what the facts were. This is not something they didn't know. They understood the law, and even before there was any well-defined law under products liability, they knew the law that once you start to speak, you must speak honestly and fully.
Well, let's suppose you're talking about selling used cars or jewels or something like that, and the seller has some information relevant to its value or dangers and doesn't disclose it. No harm occurs. There's no reliance. Why wouldn't there be similar claims in such cases?
Well, in used cars, there are actually statutes that cover that exact situation, and if you don't get the proper disclosure, you can rescind the transaction.
That's not really a helpful answer because there are a lot of products for which there are no statutes.
Your Honor, they're talking about a floodgate argument.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They can't
tell me how to close the floodgates if we were to agree with you.
I think a court has to look at the conduct in question and determine, is this the type of conduct that is so outrageous and inappropriate that a court of equity should make the defendant disgorge the profits?
Following up on what Judge Hamilton asked you, how do you distinguish this product from a billion other products that are on the market?
I can't identify another product.
Alcohol.
I'm sorry.
It's misrepresentation.
I like alcohol, and I've never been lied to by an alcohol seller.
I'm asking you a question.
I'm sorry, Judge. I apologize.
I said, how do you distinguish these sales from the sales of all kinds? Judge Hamlin mentioned jewelry, automobiles, and whatnot.
Your Honor,
how do you distinguish this from that?
I distinguish.
You're saying it's more outrageous.
I distinguish the
that's
sale.
Not a very good description.
Pardon me. I distinguish the sale of tobacco because it's an inherently dangerous and addictive product, something known to the manufacturer and something enhanced by the manufacturer in order to get people to smoke and keep smoking. And there's no other product I know of where that's true.
Why don't you say about alcohol and all the advertisements for every kind of drink, and we know all about drunk driving and alcoholics and everything else?
Your Honor, I think that it's a different situation. Alcohol is not in and of itself an inherently dangerous or addictive product. In cigarettes, tobacco is. The people who make alcohol don't try to make the product addictive. I think it's a significant distinction. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Joyce. For the defense, Ms. Odorizzi.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. Michelle Odorizzi for Philip Morris USA, Inc. I'm also appearing on behalf of all the defendants. I'd like to start with the public policy argument that you were discussing when Your Honor talked about if you allow claims where there's no injury. I think in Bridgestone, this Court said that it thought no court would do that for precisely the reason Your Honor said, because at the end of the day, there would be nothing left for people who were really injured. I think it's also important to look at the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act, because this is really a consumer fraud claim. And the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act says that only people who suffer actual damages resulting from a violation of the Act, they're the only ones who get to bring a private cause of action. But the Act does give the Attorney General of the State of Illinois the power to bring claims and to bring enforcement actions under the Consumer Fraud Act, even if there's no proof of any harm. And that is actually precisely what the Attorney General did against the tobacco companies prior to the filing of this lawsuit. The Attorney General brought claims against the tobacco companies based on violations of the Consumer Fraud Act, and that was one of the claims that resulted in the master settlement agreement between the tobacco companies, the State of Illinois, and many states, under which they have paid billions of dollars to the states. So the way that you get to this problem is not by giving private people who were not injured the right to bring lawsuits. It's by having this type of enforcement mechanism. Counsel started out his argument by saying we've conceded that they don't have a claim and therefore can sue, must have a claim for unjust enrichment. I think that's a twisting of what our argument was. In the Raintree Homes case, the Illinois Supreme Court said in that particular case, as Judge Hamilton said, that was a case in which developers wanted to get an impact fee back from the village because they said it was unconstitutional. And in that case, the court said, well, you're seeking a refund. And it said, you're not claiming any breach of duty by the village. So you don't have a claim there for breach of contract. You don't have a tort claim. You don't have a statutory claim. And therefore, if you have any claim at all for a refund, we're going to call it a claim for unjust enrichment. And the court recognized it in that context. But here, plaintiffs are claiming that the defendants breached a duty. They're claiming that we breached a duty to disclose, a duty to warn. Where do they get that duty from? Well, they have two possible sources for the duty. It could be the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act. It could be common law. They cite common law, duty to warn, personal injury. They cite misrepresentation cases.
Well, I think the Illinois Supreme Court precedent on the subject of whether there's an independent action for unjust enrichment, not that it doesn't have some underlying tort theory, is quite confusing. I don't think it's very clear whether there is such a right or there isn't. There's certainly some authority for the idea that there's an independent cause of action. You don't disagree with that, or you do?
I don't disagree with that, Your Honor.
We have precedent that says there isn't, but I don't know whether our precedent is right. But it's there, and we have to follow it.
Right.
Maybe we ought to certify this question to the Illinois Supreme Court.
I don't think so, Your Honor, because nothing turns on whether there's a separate remedy or not. I agree that there's been confusion in the Illinois decisions about that, but I think that in any case in which the defendants are claiming a breach of a duty that's essentially a tort duty or statutory duty, as they are in this case, that the courts have been, Illinois courts have been consistent in saying that you can't just throw the elements of that tort cause of action out the window and say, well, this is unjust enrichment and it has its own elements. And that's where the Illinois appellate court decisions come in. If you have a case based on use something else, breach of fiduciary duty, and you want to go get the wrongdoing fiduciary's profits, and you use unjust enrichment, you still have to show a breach of fiduciary duty. You still have to show causation. You still have to show whatever you have to show for breach of fiduciary duty. And that's our point here, that their duty that they're claiming was breached here is based in tort or the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act. And in order to get restitution, unjust enrichment, under those causes of action, you have to be able to prove the causes of action. And under none of those causes of action can you recover simply by proving that the defendant lied to you. You have to prove some causal harm. And even if...
Well, is there an Illinois Supreme Court precedent for that position?
For that particular position, I don't believe so, Your Honor. I don't think they've ever addressed it. But the appellate court decisions...
Well, then why shouldn't we certify it? We don't know what they're... They're the ultimate authority on this.
They are, Your Honor, but I think you only certify when you have great uncertainty. And here at the Illinois Appellate Court, I think on this issue that you have to, if you're basing a claim on an underlying cause of action that's essentially a tort, you have to be able to prove the tort is consistent. There's no inconsistent decision, and this court followed it in the Siegel case and was not uncertain at all about following it.
Well, right before the sentence where we said there's no independent cause of action, though, we cited the hospital case, which clearly indicates that there is.
That there was under that particular unusual circumstances. Again, what the Illinois Supreme Court has recognized it in is unusual circumstances, refund cases, and in that case was a case where you're trying to get money back from a third party. And the court created its own elements when you're trying, in addition to the basic unjust enrichment where you're trying to get money back from a third party. So, but here nothing turns on whether it's a remedy. Or a separate cause of action, because even if it is a separate cause of action, you have to look at the elements of unjust enrichment, and that gets us to the Oshana case, where this court said if there's no proof of deception, it's simply not unjust for the defendant to retain the profits of the transaction. And in their reply brief, the plaintiffs say, well, the court really didn't explain that, but I think it's quite obvious that even if somebody tries to deceive you, if you're not actually deceived, if you know what it is you're buying and you go ahead and buy it anyway, there is nothing unjust about the defendant keeping the profits from that sale. And similarly, we all agree that you have to show detriment. And what plaintiffs want to do is to completely read the concept of detriment out of their own text, because they say they don't have to show that they were hurt. They don't have to show they were deceived. They say they don't have to show that they would have changed their behavior. All they have to show is this deception in the air. And when you think about it, why should this group of people be able to sue if the claim is I was lied to? Because just because they purchased the cigarettes, wasn't everybody in Illinois lied to?
Is there under any, their theory? What are the present limitations on advertising for cigarettes? Is there, I don't have to admit, I don't pay a lot of attention to it, but are they allowed to advertise anywhere?
No, Your Honor.
Is there any other enticement or effort to get people to smoke besides...
I should correct myself. I'm not absolutely an expert on this, but I think there may be some print advertising. I know Philip Morris does not advertise.
Well, if you go by these places where they sell cigarettes, they usually got an advertisement that says how cheap they are, which ain't cheap. But nevertheless, I've seen that. But I don't know. The old days, the Marlboro Man and all that stuff, right. And they've gotten rid of all that. I just wonder what's left to entice someone to inadvertently or to smoke, I don't know, inadvertent or whatever.
Well, Your Honor, going forward, cigarettes are now regulated by the Food and Drug Administration, and there's going to be a whole lot of new regulation about the packaging, about the warnings are going to be strengthened even more. I think there's going to be a requirement that they put pictures on the labels as they do in some foreign countries. So there's when that was enacted, there's a whole lot more regulation now.
What in those studies has caused people to even start to smoke? What is it that gets people on it and addicted? We all have our own personal examples of this. I don't know how long it took my wife to quit, things like that. So there's a lot of anecdotal stuff. But I just wonder, right, somehow or other, people keep starting smoking and continue.
Well, Your Honor, all I can tell you that's in the record of this case, in the class certification record that we had, we submitted a good deal of evidence, because part of one of these claims is the lights claim, that people were that there was deception about lights. And what the evidence shows is that a very large number of people did not think that light cigarettes were any less hazardous than regular cigarettes, and that people smoked them for a whole variety of reasons, much of which had to do with taste, and that at the end of the day, many people would have continued smoking no matter what. Also, many people did get lower tar and nicotine when they smoke a single cigarette. So these are all, again, the individualized issues why they can't have a class. And after all, this is where they're going with this. It's no surprise why they're doing this. They want this court to take this extraordinary leap under Illinois law that Mr. Joyce has acknowledged there's no Illinois precedent for. There's no precedent in the country for it, so they can have a class action. Because it's quite clear that under the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act, you cannot have a class action of a cigarette case, of these deception cases, because it all turns on individual issues of, were people deceived? Did it cause them to do anything different? And ultimately, to go to Judge Cudahy's question, you don't have to send this to the Illinois Supreme Court, because there are multiple ways you can approach it. And even if you assume it's a separate cause of action, they lose, because it's not unjust unless there's deception, causation, injury, and there's no detriment. At least they have to show that they changed their position.
But it's hard to describe the industry's actions, as alleged by plaintiffs, as anything other than unjust. Your detriment argument may have some traction, but I don't think you want to get us, you're not trying to convince us to bless what the tobacco industry has done, I trust.
No, Your Honor, but I think that the, and by the way, we do dispute the allegations, but that's beside the point. It's coming
right
to you on the allegations. But it's not to say that we're talking about the conduct. Here, the question is whether the retention of the benefit is unjust, whether the retention of the profits is unjust vis-a-vis the particular plaintiff. And if a particular plaintiff buys a product without deception, knowing what it is, that's why it's not unjust. And that's what O'Shana said. That's what this court said in the O'Shana case in upholding a denial of class certification. So we would ask, Your Honors, to affirm the judgment below. There's no need to certify this to the Illinois Supreme Court because, as I say, there are so many problems with this argument. There's just no way that you can turn this unjust enrichment claim into a claim that enables plaintiffs to sue on behalf of people who had no detriment, who were not deceived.
Thank you, counsel.
Let's
see, Mr. Joyce, why don't you take 3 minutes, a little extra time.
The defendants didn't cite Bridgestone in their brief, but I assume it was a fair response to what I argued. If it turns out Bridgestone is something I'd like to address, I'll file a 28J letter. But the defendants also have stated here categorically, no plaintiff was injured, no plaintiff was deceived. There's no record on those issues because we don't regard those as being an element of the cause of action. So it's unfair to say they weren't injured and weren't deceived. It's just not an element of the cause of action.
You're not alleging it.
You're not alleging it. We don't believe we have to, but I think the very nature of the questions that this panel asked myself and my opposing counsel demonstrate that it would be appropriate for the Illinois Supreme Court to address these issues and give everyone the guidance that is necessary to know the parameters of an unjust enrichment case and to know what they regard as detriment. And to me, there's a procedure that's set up that works as logical.
You don't have to allege detriment or harm in any form?
Not the way I read the Illinois Supreme Court's decision. If you look back also at English common law where this came from, you weren't required to allege those things because the only focus on the defendant's wrongful retention of a profit as opposed to the plaintiff's damage.
Well, why is it wrongful if there isn't any harm? I don't really understand that.
Well, see, that's the way they want to phrase the question. We believe that we will establish there is harm to demonstrate the outrageousness of the conduct, but
well,
we don't have to show that we were harmed. I'm sorry.
You have not alleged
We have not alleged that, but we have alleged conduct that a court would conclude harmed people. And the defendant didn't care that they were harmed. They knew they would be harmed. But it's not an element of our cause of action. It's what makes their conduct the kind of conduct that should result in disgorgement.
I mean, we're just concerned with the emotional state of the tobacco companies as opposed to what impact it has on the public?
Well, I think that if you were to decide in our favor, it would have a very good impact on the public, and it might chasten the tobacco companies. They've been getting away with this for years, making billions of dollars of profits at the expense of the public. But my last comment, unless you have a question, is it's amazing that they point to the Attorney General's settlement. The Attorney General's settlement was based on the tobacco company raising the price of cigarettes to addicted smokers so they could pass on that increased price to the government. That's not a very good settlement from a plaintiff's point of view. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Joyce. The case will be taken under advisement.